Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I am your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Timothy C.F. Stunt. Timothy is an independent scholar and author of a huge number of publications in the history of the Plymouth Brethren and other radical religious movements. His published work includes From Awakening to Secession, published by T&T Clark in 2000, for which he was awarded a Cambridge University PhD. He's the author of some 40 contributions to the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography and is well known for his work on the history of the Brethren movement and also the biography of John Nelson Darby, one of its principal theorists. Timothy, it's great to have you on the show. Congratulations on the book.
My pleasure to be with you.
Today we're talking about your new book, which is called The Life and Times of Samuel Predo Tregellis, a Forgotten Scholar, published by Palgrave Macmillan earlier this year. You've been working on this book for a long time, you tell us in the preface, some 60 years. But before we begin talking about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps some of the things that you've been working on over those number of decades?
Well, I'm a retired teacher, and the victims who've been taught by me are teenagers. And people always ask me why I haven't got a job in a university. Well, I like teaching teenagers, but 45 years of doing it was enough. And I'm now retired, and I'm living in Florida, where the temperature is far more agreeable for my body, which has undergone some serious surgery in just 5 years ago. And very, very thankful to be alive, to learn that for 5 years I've been cancer-free is something worthy of rejoicing.
Absolutely. And it's great that one of the consequences of that successful surgery has been the publication of this book, The Life and Times of Samuel Predo Tregellis. Could you tell us something about the background to this book and perhaps how it flowed out of your earlier work on the Brethren movement?
Well, that's the interesting part about it, because it is my earlier work. I became interested in Tregellis before I became interested in the Brethren. I was brought up in the Brethren, and I know them from the inside, so to speak. But I got interested in Tregellis because I discovered his name the introduction to a Greek New Testament that my father gave me on my 15th birthday. And when I tried to find out about Tregellis, he wasn't in my father's Encyclopedia Britannica. And my father sent me to the local library, and I found the Dictionary of National Biography, and I discovered that not only was Tregellis a scholar, but he also was a Plymouth Brother for a time. And that was a worthy of celebration from my point of view, because I grew up in the Brethren and was repeatedly faced with the question, are we peculiar because we are Brethren, or are we Brethren because we're peculiar? And to discover that a world famous scholar had been a Plymouth Brother was a great discovery. Perhaps we weren't quite so peculiar as I thought we were. And I've been interested in Tregennis ever since. And curiously enough, it was through him that I got interested in the Brethren. And then I got interested in European evangelicalism, and the whole thing burgeoned and became much, much, much bigger subject. But it started with Tregennis, and I came back to him just after my surgery 5 years ago, and got down to writing the biography that I've been thinking about and researching for the previous 60 years.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. As you thought about Tregellis, how important did you discern his family background among Quakers and also his origins in the southwest of England?
Well, the Quakers were a strange group of people. They were famous for their honesty and their integrity, but they were modest, retiring. They didn't go in the limelight. They worked behind the scenes. They were quietly industrious, and that sort of morality is typical of Tregennis through and through. He was an autodidact. He went to school, and he left school at about 15. And he didn't go to university, even though his headmaster would have liked him to try for university, because the Quakers were dissenters and weren't able to go to university. And being a fairly strict Quaker family, they wouldn't have dreamt of them becoming Anglican just so their son could go to university. So he's completely self-taught, apart from his basic schooling when he did Latin and like everybody else. I think that's a very important element in his makeup. You ask about his Cornish background. Yeah, he was born in Falmouth, and he later on went to Wales as a teenager, and he got very interested in the Welsh language. And there's a side to him which is involved with Celtic studies, and he's fascinated by the Welsh language. He taught himself Welsh at the same time as teaching himself Hebrew. And he was a very gifted linguist. But whether you can say that it's a Cornish upbringing, it's not really very significant, though he chose to live almost in Cornwall, in Plymouth, for the rest of his life.
It's fascinating that he was so interested in Welsh. Did he have any corresponding interest in Cornish Celtic culture?
Well, he's interested in the the French ramifications of he visits Brittany as an older man, and there, his interest in the old Welsh stories, and he sees the parallels between the Welsh stories and the early Frankish stories. But it runs in parallel with his biblical studies.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned his biblical studies there, Timothy. Obviously, Tregellis growing up in a Quaker family had a good knowledge of the Bible, but at some point he became an evangelical, and you suggest in the book that sometime, I think, after his Hebrew studies begin. How did that happen, and what were some of the influences that shaped his early evangelical convictions?
Well, his early life was very much a Quaker life, and the Quakers respect the scriptures, but they believe in the inward light. And they say that the spirit is really more important than the word of the scripture. Tregelius wasn't an evangelical Quaker. He was very much an ordinary, old-fashioned, in a light Quaker. But he had a distant relation. One of his distant cousins was married, or was planning on getting married, to B.W. Newton, Benjamin Newton, who also had been a Quaker, but who had an evangelical conversion when he was a young man at Oxford. And Tregelius met Newton and raised some questions that he had about biblical, the reliability of the Bible. And Newton so impressed him that he soon afterwards had an evangelical conversion, and he looked up to Newton as his mentor for the rest of his life. Interestingly enough, Newton lived for another 25 years after Tregelius had died. Newton, a very individual, a very unusual individual, but who made a huge impression on Tregelius. And one thing that Tregelius adopted from Newton's background was his complete faith in the scriptures. Newton was a believer in plenary inspiration. And what is apparent is that as soon as he had an evangelical conversion, Tregelius adopted the same attitude to the scriptures. They were totally reliable. And this marks him off from quite a lot of other evangelicals, because as the century went on and as Tregelius grew older, he found himself more and more in a slightly isolated position by the total belief in the inspiration of Scripture.
And obviously his commitment to Scripture was a key component of his evangelical faith, wasn't it? You show in the book that around the same time that he becomes an evangelical, he identifies with a new religious movement in which Newton was a leading figure. This is the group known as the Plymouth Brethren. Who were they? Were they very unlike the Quaker community that he had been part of? And why did Tregelius identify with them?
Well, he identified with them because they were, it was Newton's way of his ecclesiastical position. Newton had been a key figure in the establishment of the Brethren Assembly, as they called them, in Plymouth. And it was natural, if he was converted through the testimony of Newton, Tregelius joined in. But there were other Quakers who had joined in as well. And there are some similarities between the Brethren and the Quakers. The one that most people know about is the fact that they don't have a formal liturgy. And their worship meetings are very spontaneous, and they would say spirit-led. In that sense, there's a sort of Quaker atmosphere in which Tregelius would have been at home. But they are an unusual group of people. But we're dealing with the very earliest. Tregelius was converted in about 1835. And the Plymouth Brethren, the original Plymouth Brethren Assembly, had only been in existence for 3 or 4 years. But in that assembly, he met a man called George Wigram, who was producing a concordance, a Greek concordance and a Hebrew concordance. And this was just the work that Tregennis was made for. He was a linguist. He was obsessed with detail and very, very systematic and scholarly, and a very good linguist. And his commitment to that concordance made him realize how important establishing the text of the scriptures was, and how unreliable the standard translations and texts that were available, how unreliable they were.
I think one of the things that your book does brilliantly, Timothy, is to show how intellectually exciting and stimulating these early communities of brethren must have been for young people like Tregellis coming into them for the first time. So if this was such an important part of his evangelical life, why did he eventually leave the brethren?
Well, that's a complicated question. The brethren were a very mixed bag. If somebody asks you, what did the brethren believe? Or if somebody asked in 1835, what did the brethren believe? The reply would have been, well, we tell you what they do and how they behave and what their church life is like. But some of them believe in this and some of them believe in that and some of them believe in the other. And Tregellis and Newton had a rather different attitude to church life and to biblical studies than other ones in the brethren. And particularly there was a collision between the strong character, B.W. Newton, who was Tregellis's mentor, and John Nelson Darby, who is famously associated with the Plymouth Brethren. And as time went on, Newton found himself in a minority, and there was a personal hostility from Darby, which resulted in Newton being sidelined and being effectively excommunicated from the Brethren. And Tregellis chose to go with Newton and remained for the rest of his life obsessed with what was wrong with the Brethren rather than how he admitted that he had been involved with them, but he turned his back on them. Mm. And in my book, I refer to it as something like a nemesis, that he had this, he was looking over his shoulder all the time, looking back to the early days and trying to explain why he had been mistaken in the first place.
So he emerges really as an intellectual figure within the Brethren community, and his goal, very quickly identified goal, is to establish a critical text of the New Testament. Did he find that an easy project?
He wanted somebody else to do it, and he was very clear as he was getting going in his work of textual criticism. He says in several places that he approached scholars whom he reckoned were much more learned than himself and said, why don't you do this? But none of them would accept the responsibility. So he said, okay, I'll do it myself. But he was very aware that he didn't have a university degree, or he was given one later on out of respect for his published work. But he was an autodidact. He was self-taught, and he was very aware of that. That in one place in one of his letters, he says, "I'm learning as I go along," and it would be so much better if somebody else who had the learning to begin with could do this work.
And how did his more formally qualified colleagues view his contribution? Did they Did they help him? Did they want to be identified with it? Or did some of them perhaps feel threatened by it or even hostile towards it?
Well, one in particular felt threatened by it, and that was his often considered to be his rival, Constantine von Tischendorf. But Tischendorf was a very self-centered man. He was very ambitious. Tregennis wasn't really ambitious. He saw his work of producing a reliable text of the scriptures, something that he was doing for the church, for Christians everywhere. And he always said, my work is available for anybody who wants to use it. He wasn't really in a rat race with Tischendorf, but Tischendorf felt threatened by his rivalry. In contrast to Tischendorf, there were several English scholars who, like William Cureton and
Hort,
West Scotland Hort, and later on, Bishop Christopher Wordsworth. Tregennis was on good terms with these people, Hort particularly. And Hort was a younger man, and he looked up to Tregennis and said, I feel rather sorry for Tregennis because he's stuck there down in Plymouth all on his own, and everybody there thinks he's sort of rather strange because he hasn't got any scholars around him with whom he can share his work. And by and large, the other scholars respected what he did, and they valued what he did because Tregennis, in the case of West Cotton Hall, Tregennis made available even before the volumes of his Greek New Testament were published. He made the proof pages available for Hort to consult even before they were published.
His relationships with these colleagues in the field are quite remarkable in the way you describe them in the book. Tischendorf comes across almost as an acidic critic, whereas Hort, as you've just indicated, seems genuinely to admire the older man Tregellis and perhaps even to feel sorry for him in some respects. Does that give us any clue as to what Tregellis was like as an individual?
Well, yes, it does, because Tregennis, I admire the man because he's a scholar, but I don't think he was necessarily the nicest person to know. He could be sarcastic. He didn't suffer fools gladly. If people got it wrong, as he saw them, if he thought they were wrong and they'd made a mistake, he didn't let them off the hook and say, oh, well, we'll make allowances. He stood up for what he believed to be true. And my goodness, when Tregellis believed something was true, he really believed it. And he defended it to his dying day. And he made a lot of, I wouldn't say enemies, but he isolated himself from people because people said, well, you can't really argue with Tregennis. He knows his stuff. And given his basic starting point, he's consistent. But he didn't make friends that way. And both he and Newton, as the years went by, are more and more and more isolated, not just from people who, not just from non-evangelicals, but even from the holiness movement associated with Keswick and that variety of Christianity. Tregennis was very impatient with them. He called them dreamy, sentimental Christians. They're not interested in truth, he said. They're just interested in having nice, warm feelings for each other, and they're not concerned about truth. And he and Newton both become more and more isolated as they go on.
And yet, as your book shows, for all that he was an isolated figure, and for all that Tregellis was also suspicious of lowering doctrinal standards, he was also quite surprisingly ecumenical in some of his friendships, wasn't he? And he must have been one of the very few Englishmen to have met the Pope.
Yes, indeed. And he only met the Pope. He felt the need to apologise for having met the Pope. He was aware that that wasn't what he was really, that wasn't something he could be proud of. And he only met the Pope because he was desperately trying to get access to the Codex Vaticanus in the Vatican Library. But on the other hand, as you say, he did meet a lot of scholars, and although he was very rigidly, fervently anti-Roman Catholic, he was critical of Roman Catholicism, and it's not too strong a word to say, he hated the Roman Catholic system. I emphasize the word system because he repeatedly met delightful Roman Catholic scholars in German libraries and Bavarian libraries and Italian libraries. He repeatedly met these Roman Catholic scholars who charmed him and who helped him and who were extremely cooperative. And his experience in Rome with the Codex Vaticanus is not typical. In Rome, they didn't cooperate. They didn't let him consult the Codex Vaticanus. But elsewhere, in his travels in Europe, he met very, very. He discovered a fellowship of scholars, which didn't worry about labels. So some of them were Catholics, and even more remarkable, some of them didn't believe in the plenary inspiration of the Bible, but he discovered that they were scholars and that they were very, very charming with it. There's one particular example, De Wet, whom he met in Rome, but who was a professor in Basel in Switzerland, and who was very helpful for Tregellis. And Tregellis kept on saying how much he appreciated the man,
even though I can't agree with his views on scripture.
Very good. Well, obviously, Tregellis's work on his textual criticism was very much impaired by his health, wasn't it? He had to take numerous visits to various locations to try to improve his health. And you describe, I think, quite a moving way, the stroke that he suffered towards the end of his life and the way in which his life came to a rather premature end. Could you tell us a little bit more about the circumstances of that?
Well, his real weakness physically, okay, he had a stroke, and then he had two strokes, one from which he virtually recovered and one from which he never recovered. But long before that, he had serious problems with his eyesight. We know that at the age of 40, he was wearing spectacles. We just happen to know because somebody describes him in a particular year, and we can work out his age from that fact. But his eyesight was weak, and he frequently refers to his inability to work for long periods of time. And the headaches that go with it. And one suggestion has been made that it was aggravated by the chemicals which he used to decipher the Codex Dublinensis, which is a palimpsest. And to read the writing underneath, he used a chemical treatment, and this may have aggravated his eyesight. But you're quite right. He wasn't a strong man, and this attention to, I mean, of all things, to have bad eyesight when you're dealing with the minutiae of text and reading palimpsests, badly written 700-year-old manuscripts. That's a recipe for problems.
Now you tell us in the subtitle to your new book, The Life and Times of Samuel Prideaux Tregellis, that Tregellis is a forgotten scholar. And yet he also has an important legacy, doesn't he? And in some ways that legacy is beginning to be rediscovered.
That's right. He was a forgotten scholar because his Greek New Testament came out just at the same time, or just before, the revised version of the Bible, which was based on the scholarship of Westcott and Hort. And Westcott and Hort's Greek New Testament has always overshadowed Tregellis, partly because they expounded their theory of transmission very ably, and but they were in favour with the establishment, and so Tregellis' contribution is also ran. Running along beside the other work, but what is curious in the situation today is that when most scholars have abandoned the idea of plenary inspiration and are even saying that it's an impossible task to try and work out what the original text of the scriptures were, they've come up with a new technique of textual criticism, which I don't understand because I'm not a linguistic scholar. And what I'm a bit relieved to discover is that almost nobody else understands it either. And it has the very intimidating title that they call it, the coherence based genealogical method, and it establishes families of manuscripts and their descent from earlier manuscripts, and in establishing that they can use computers to find out the frequency of certain variations. And so they can work out which are the earliest and which was the original text. And they've done this on the Catholic epistles, and they've actually published the Editio Critica Major for the Catholic epistles. And one of the great textual scholars, David Parker, has done a close study of the Book of James as it's found in the Editio Critica Major, and he finds that it repeatedly seems to come up with the same text as Tregellis came up with for the Book of James. And he's even suggested that the new text could be called the New Tregellis, whereas most scholars would have said, oh, it's the New Tischendorf. But apparently, I speak as an ignorant person when it comes to linguistics, but apparently his text looks as if it may be vindicated by this new research method.
Fascinating. Tregellis gets the last laugh.
Well, I don't think he was very good at laughing. I think he was basically a very serious man. But he could get enthusiastic. And so sometimes there's one splendid little passage in one of his letters where he says these people were complaining about textual criticism. They were saying, and they were mocking the textual critics and said, when the Lord returns at the second coming, there'll be some people so busy trying to establish the text that they won't be ready for him. And Tregelius, in self-defense, said to these people, has it ever occurred to you that it's not exactly biblical to have a printed Bible? Because there's no reference to having the scriptures in print in the early years of the church.
I was really struck by the anecdote that you include in the book, Timothy, where the party of ladies comes to visit Tregelis and his wife, and they ask one or two innocent dinner table conversation type questions about textual criticism, and he rushes off to the study and brings back all these tracings of manuscripts and treats them to a full lecture on the principles of text criticism and the difficulties that he encountered.
The interesting thing about that story is that the ladies in question were his distant cousins, and they had played with him when they were kids. And in the letter, the one of these middle-aged cousins says, "This was our little prid," as they called him, when he was only a child. This is our little prid holding forth with this huge enthusiasm.
Sounds like a wonderful evening, doesn't it? Well, Timothy, yeah. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for coming on to the show and talking about this really important new book, The Life and Times of Samuel Prideaux Tregelis, A Forgotten Scholar, just published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you for your time and take care.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.